At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Some tech, some big pharma news, a quick swing through Europe, and a chat with our rancher in Rolla, Missouri. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. It is the 23rd of August. This one is a Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A tale of two stocks to get us going today. The yin and the yang, if you will, of today's tech economy. On the cutting edge, ticker symbol TSLA, Tesla, which announced a new battery for its cars this afternoon, a new battery that will make Teslas the first production electric cars to go more than 300 miles on a single charge. A milepost, yes, but apparently not one investors gave much of a hoot about. Shares up a mere 0.8% at the bell. Best Buy, on the other hand, BBY on your ticker if you're playing along at home. Nobody's idea of a cutting-edge electronics retailer. Had a monster day, up 19% after a huge jump in profits. Investors and probably non-investors, too, were surprised, given all the constant talk of Amazon crushing those brick-and-mortar retailers. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on why and how Best Buy, which is 50 years old this week, 5-0, why it hasn't gone the way of Radio Shack or Circuit City.
Techies love to snicker at the idea of walking into a Best Buy, but the world is still full of people who don't want to make big technology purchases online. RJ Hottovy is Morningstar's senior retail analyst.
Best Buy is a place where people who are a little bit more uncomfortable about technology perhaps make their purchases, and I think that's helping drive results. It is still a place where people can go out and try out the latest technologies.
And this is part of why CEO Hubert Joly, in a call with Wall Street analysts, embraced Best Buy's brick-and-mortar side.
Given the complexity of technology and the needs of our customers, our stores are a key asset for us. The level of proficiency and engagement of our associates is continuing to increase.
He cites higher customer satisfaction scores as evidence investments in employee training are paying off. The company has also cut costs so it can offer shoppers competitive prices in stores and on its website. Online sales in the U.S. grew 24%. Citigroup's Kate McShane follows the company.
Best Buy has reached, you know, a very good balance of investing in the store and online, and because of that, they've survived and they've prospered.
Down the road, emerging products may bring more shoppers into Best Buy stores. It's hard to see what the fuss is over a 4K television unless you see one in person, much like virtual reality, as John Talbot of Indiana University's Business School explains.
We're talking about pretty expensive devices and a technology where there, you know, there's limited understanding, and obviously you have to actually try them.
It's still tough out there, but Best Buy is a long way from being one more brick-and-mortar casualty. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
The start of the school year can be an expensive time with book bags and computers and new clothes to be bought. But for parents of kids with severe allergies, it's a far more expensive shopping trip than it used to be. The price for EpiPens, those pen-like devices that auto-inject potentially life-saving drugs into people having severe allergic reactions, price has risen anywhere from 400% to 600% the past couple of years, depending on how you run the numbers. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looks at why and at who's paying.
We caught Adrienne Stick Butler while she was doing her back-to-school shopping. Her daughter has multiple and severe food allergies, so Butler has to buy 6 EpiPens every year.
Never quite prepared for, like, the big wallop that is the price tag for the EpiPens, but, you know, there's no choice. You have to get them.
EpiPens, sold by drug company Mylan, are generally considered to be the easiest of the auto-injectors to use. Most of its competitors have stopped selling in the U.S., and Mylan has hiked up the price. About a decade ago, EpiPens cost about $100 for a set of 2. Now, it's more than $600. But who pays?
It turns out that most poor individuals covered by Medicaid have coverage for the device. It's not an issue.
Dr. James Baker is CEO at the nonprofit Food Allergy Research and Education.
What we're seeing is that people who are insurance plans that have larger out-of-pockets are having to pay this entire price now.
Dr. Richard Sagel is president of Needy Meds, which helps people find programs to lower their health care costs.
Well, I can tell you that we're receiving more phone calls to our helpline for people looking for assistance with the EpiPen because of the increasing cost.
Mylan sent us a statement pointing to several programs offering coupons and discounts, which the company says support access to treatment. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
If you care to read it, we've got Mylan's whole statement on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. Today in the tit for tat that is campaign 2016, more of the same, Clinton and the foundation and the emails, Trump and today immigration and minority voters. It continues to be, shall we say, an unusual election. That extends to the candidate's personal finances as well. Let's just say whoever designed those financial disclosure forms didn't have this election in mind. Donald Trump's disclosure forms, for instance, show he has connections with hundreds and hundreds of companies, but not much about those connections at all. So Marketplace's Adam Allington reports on what those forms can tell us and what they can't.
Trump golf courses, Trump vineyards, Trump's modeling agency, these are just some of the businesses Donald Trump made money from last year. That's according to a 104-page personal financial disclosure form. What the form doesn't tell us, however, is how much money Trump actually made or how much he's worth.
That's because the purpose of these forms is not to show net worth at all.
So says Sheila Krumholtz, executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics. What the forms are intended to do is flag potential conflicts of interests. Trump's filing lists connections to over 540 separate companies.
Like LLCs and corporations that manage the Trump trademark. And the value of those things is really tough to ascertain unless it actually gets put up for sale.
In other words, Krumholtz says, a list of assets doesn't really tell you how these businesses are run or what the balance sheet looks like.
His holdings are very, you know, complex, and the form is not.
Rob Kellner is with the law firm Covington & Burling in Washington, D.C.
The form was intended to deal with, you know, your average candidate who had some mutual funds and maybe even had some money in a hedge fund.
Kellner says a better way to ensure transparency would be to continue to require candidates to file financial disclosures, that's the law, but also make them disclose their tax returns. That's precedent, but not a law. Trump hasn't released his tax return, citing an IRS audit. He's the only candidate who's refused to do so since Richard Nixon. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, strong-ish start, weak-ish finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. German Chancellor Angela Merkel's got a busy week ahead of her. She's off on a week-long post-Brexit tour of Europe, meetings with a dozen European leaders in six cities, trying to figure out where the alliance goes once the Brits are out, whenever that happens. It is yet another, as if we really needed it, another indication of Merkel's European and global standing. Matthew Vortrup is a professor of political science at Coventry University over in the UK. His new biography is called Angela Merkel, Europe's Most Influential Leader. Matthew, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
This is a woman who, because of the Cold War and geopolitics of the time, sprang almost fully formed on the international political scene after 1989. Is that a basic outline?
That is a basic outline. What is interesting about that is that there is less than a year from her handing out leaflets and being the absolutely most junior person in a small, small political party to her being a cabinet minister in a reunited Germany less than a year later. So it's the most astounding rise in probably in political history, really.
A brief detour here into her pre-1989 life. Lived, obviously, in a communist society, turns out to be exceptionally bright, speaks fluent Russian, daughter of a Lutheran minister, right, in East Germany?
Yes. Yes, the parents actually lived in Hamburg in West Germany before, and then the bishop of Hamburg said, we need people to preach the gospel in communist East Germany. So the parents go the other way. So when over a million people are escaping East Germany, they travel the other way, as it were, like refugees, really. Then in her life, she grows up in the way of this sort of Stalinist state, in the way that most people do, is very uninterested in politics, is a barmaid. At some stage, she's a squatter, Angela, as she calls herself, hasn't got her doctorate after 7 years when she's living illegally in Berlin, but eventually she gets her doctorate and works as a quantum chemist at the Academy of Sciences in Berlin. And then the war comes down and the rest literally is history.
She is, as a politician, and you sort of trace this through her childhood as well, she is cautious and deliberative, and she views hesitancy in making big decisions as a virtue.
She does, and it's interesting that every year in Germany they have the German word of the year, which is sort of a new word that has been created. And in 2015, the new German word was zu Merkeln, or to Merkel, which means somebody who sort of, you know, deliberates, considers, and sometimes take a long time to make a decision. But once the decision is made, she takes it. And that's been sort of like the pattern throughout her life. Whenever there's a political crisis, she won't necessarily just come out and make a statement on the day when it has happened. You know, scary stuff, but eventually she'll make a jump.
Which gets us now sort of to today and the Brexit vote and her relationship with Theresa May, the new Prime Minister of Great Britain, which I imagine is going to be an interesting geopolitical and economic relationship to watch.
It is. I remember about 10 years ago, I was on a platform with Theresa May, and Angela Merkel had not been in power for a long time. And she asked, who is this German woman? And I said, well, she's quite pragmatic. She's quite tough. She's not very flashy. And she's a vicar's daughter. And Theresa May then said to me, well, she's a bit like me then. Hmm. And what was interesting about the press conference that Angela Merkel and Theresa May had was that that after all the sort of the niceties, and I'm sure we're going to get on, we're both vicar's daughter, which Angela Merkel said, she also then said, but by the way, there will be no cherry picking. You either have to accept the deal, you have to pay into the budget. So she's going to be very nice, but incredibly tough. But I think the Germans feel they've got the you know, a good bargaining position, and they will not be easy to deal with.
It's a book about Angela Merkel called Angela Merkel, Europe's Most Influential Leader, by Matthew Vortrup. Matthew, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Last August, Environmental Protection Agency workers and contractors in Colorado accidentally released 3 million gallons of wastewater from the Gold King Mine into the river system down in the southwest corner of that state. It has been cleaned up, but there is still that small matter of lost revenue for the businesses and farmers that work and live along the water. Grace Hood from Colorado Public Radio has that story.
In Colorado, nothing quite says summer like a rafting trip down thrilling rapids. Each July and August, visitors flock to the southwestern Colorado town of Durango to take a ride that resembles a bucking bronco. Dylan and Elizabeth Burton from Washington State are still riding a rush of adrenaline.
That was perfect. Beautiful. Fantastic in every way possible.
Yeah, great. It was my first time, so I really enjoyed it.
Flashback 1 year ago, though, and this riverfront looked different. The county government shut it down after the EPA accidentally spilled wastewater 50 miles upstream. Cities and farmers scrambled to turn off water intake valves. Ultimately, the river was off limits to rafters, farmers, everybody for 8 days. Matt Wilson owns and operates Four Corners Whitewater.
Ballpark revenue loss was right around $30,000.
Wilson's business was one of about six Colorado rafting companies affected. The river is his livelihood. He says canceled trips and no customers for over a week caused a big disruption.
So after that, it was hard to kind of reboot and get people back on the water after all that publicity and everything.
He filled out a financial claim with the Environmental Protection Agency. Water quality on the Animas River has returned to pre-spill conditions, and the 2016 summer rafting season has been strong. But 1 year later, Wilson says he wants his money.
Yeah, we submitted that to the EPA, and we're still waiting.
Overall, 68 businesses across Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and the Navajo Nation are in limbo. A few miles away at City Hall, Durango Councilor Dean Brookey says his government is in another type of holding pattern. It spent $445,000 responding to the spill.
That would be from personnel that we assigned to cleanup effort, the equipment costs supplied by the city of Durango.
So far, the EPA has paid the city $45,000. Brookie says Durango's budget is holding strong without the remaining funds, but other smaller communities may not have as much in reserves. Laura Jenkins with the EPA says the agency continues to work with local governments.
You know, we are limited by what the regulations allow us to reimburse communities for. And so they have to meet the requirements that are in the statutes.
The EPA says laws like the Clean Water Act govern what's reimbursable for communities. So far, it's spent $3.7 million on everything from overtime pay to local water quality monitoring. But there are other things that aren't covered. In some places, like New Mexico, talks have broken down.
It was just continual failed efforts.
Tanya Maestas works in the New Mexico Attorney General's office. The state sued the EPA this spring. She says the state received over $1 million, but it only covers a fraction of the $130 million in estimated damages. The lawsuit covers everything from water quality monitoring to payment to local businesses for their losses.
It's our experience that the EPA has met all of these requests with either challenges, resistance, or delays.
Other governments are following New Mexico's path to court. The Navajo Nation filed suit against the EPA earlier this month. In Durango, Colorado, I'm Grace Hood for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The more I saw of it, the less I wanted. If I want to do that, I'll go to Las Vegas and have some fun spending my money.
Gambling on the hoof. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tipped up 17 points today, a 10th percent, 18,547. The NASDAQ jumped 15 points, 3/10 percent, finished at 5260. The S&P 500, 4 points to the good, 2/10 percent, 21.86. With Fed Chair Janet Yellen set to speak later this week out in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, financial firms were looking for a little mixed up. Bank of America deposited more than 1%. Morgan Stanley took home an extra 0.4%, but Wells Fargo reversed itself 0.4%. Builders nailed down big gains on news that sales of single-family homes hit a 9-year high last month. Toll Brothers bounced up more than 8%. KB Homes stepped up close to 5%. Day bonds did nothing at all. The yield on the 10-year T-note held steady at 1.54%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There is news this week of volatility in the cattle futures market, making cattle ranching an already tough way of life just a little bit tougher. Good thing for us, then, that we know a guy who knows a little something about that life. Ken Lennox has been raising cattle in Rolla, Missouri for a good long while now. Mr. Lennox, it is good to talk to you again, sir.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Kai.
How are the cattle, first of all? How's business?
They're having a great summer. It's grass is high, probably the best that I've seen for this time of year ever.
Yeah, it seems to me every time we call you about this time of year, it's there's always some kind of drought or there's flooding or something's gone wrong. Maybe not this year, huh?
Not this year. You're right, and that's well appreciated.
What do you do with them during the summertime? You just let them eat and get fat?
Yeah, you rotate them. We put them up on the hills, and they go after the warm season grass, the native, that grows in the summer. The cool seasons we save back for the when they're starting to calve, which give it another 10 days, and I'll have them hitting the ground.
Oh, hitting the ground, is that what you say? Is that what you say about the calves that are coming?
No, the babies.
Oh, the babies are coming, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, we'll have probably in the month of September 300, 350 born.
One of the reasons we called you, Mr. Lennox, other than to just say hi, was to ask you about how the meat market is going, how the cattle market is going. What kind of prices are you getting when you take these cattle to market now?
Well, about half of what we did last year. It's still some profit in it. It's not like we're underwater or anything, but I sold for $3 last year. And $1.60, $1.70 this year.
I saw a great phrase the other day when I was getting ready to talk to you this afternoon. The meat casino, some people are calling it. You kind of never know what's going on. It's up and it's down and it's a little bit volatile.
Well, when I was a younger man and they came out with the futures, I thought I might want to participate in that. The more I saw of it, the less I wanted. If I want to do that, I'll go to Las Vegas and... and have some fun spending my money.
Do you actually take your cattle to the market? Do you load them in a truck and send them to wherever you go to sell them?
Yes, that's exactly what we do. And it's a cash buy. Let me put it this way. The vast majority of the ranchers who raise feeder cattle, they don't use the futures market.
Huh.
It's speculators and your feedlots that use it more than anything.
Yeah, and you all just want cash on the barrelhead, right?
That's exactly right. We want to take the check home and put them in the bank.
Yeah. How are things otherwise on the ranch there, sir? I mean, as we've talked about before, you're not getting any younger.
No, but I've got help now. My oldest daughter and her family came home and built a house, and she's out working today with me. And we're getting along great. I'm just enjoying the heck out of it.
Well, that's good. Ken Lennox in Rolla, Missouri. We'll talk to you again soon, sir, all right?
Okay, thank you. Have a good one.
We talked a bit yesterday about Turkey and the once and perhaps future refugee crisis if talks between Turkey and the European Union break down. Today, a moment for the refugees who've already gotten to Europe, France in particular. Paris has started building two urban refugee camps within city limits. It's modular housing for more than 1,000 people. Emma Jacobs has that one.
The city's refugee housing project was news to Afghan refugee Sami Achaksai when I met him last month, but he could attest to the need. Since arriving in Paris 3 weeks before, after facing anti-immigrant sentiment in Germany, Achaksai had slept under elevated metro tracks not far from the public plaza where we met. He was struggling with the daily essentials, like finding a shower.
And it is now 2.5 weeks that I didn't have taken bath. When I go to the public shower, they don't give me the permission to insert. They tell me you don't have the shampoo or you don't have the towel.
The refugee centers, or welcome centers, will provide shelter and showers. One is for single men, like Achaksai, the other for women and children. Announced in May by Mayor Anne Hidalgo, the exact locations have not been shared because city officials are afraid of protests. But one will be in a dense neighborhood of northeast Paris, known for its large immigrant population, and the other in the south of the city. The French government has concerns the project could attract more refugees to Paris, but Hidalgo argues the city needs to address the growing numbers of people living in public spaces. News channels have carried uncomfortable reports like this one on BFM TV, showing regular evacuations of tent cities carried out by police in riot gear. The residents are sent to shelters, but many come back, says Manana Handa. She works with a coalition of volunteers providing food and support to migrants, who are mostly from Afghanistan, Eritrea, and Sudan. She points out fencing that has been put up under the rail line to try and keep the encampments from reappearing. Ahanda says the tent cities are so hard to eliminate because many shelters provide only short-term housing. Then an estimated 50 to 100 migrants still arrive in the city every day. Paris was inspired by a refugee camp recently constructed outside the town of Grand Sainte by Doctors Without Borders. For about $4 million, the organization put up hundreds of wooden huts for mostly Iraqi families who had been living very rough while waiting to find a way across the English Channel to the UK. In Paris, those who win the right to stay in France will struggle to find permanent housing in a tough and bureaucratic Paris rental market. But Ahanta says, in the midterm, it's better than nothing. And right now, there is really nothing for new arrivals. Achakse agreed. Only in his early 20s, he has both stylish bleach highlights at the tips of his hair, but also a scattering of white hairs around his temples.
There was zero white hair in my hair, but now it's all because of the tension and because of the hard way, because of the hard trips.
For the moment, he stopped traveling. But since we spoke, his refugee application in France has been denied, and he faces deportation back to Germany. In Paris, I'm Emma Jacobs for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, I'm just going to play the tape. You get to decide. Here you go.
Introducing the KFC Extra Crispy Sunscreen.
Extra crispy.
A real limited edition product that we are giving away for free. It works just like regular sunscreen, but it smells like fried chicken.
Did you hear the sizzle there? How awesome was that? Two things about that thing. Number one, KFC clearly thinks we're idiots because they say like three times in that ad not to eat this stuff because, you know, it's sunscreen. Also, the guy playing Colonel Sanders at the end, which we didn't play for you, he's George Hamilton, the always tanned icon of 30 years ago, which actually was pretty clever. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 17 points today, 10th percent, 18,547 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ 15 points higher, 0.3%, 52.60. The S&P 500 gained 4 points, 0.2%. 2186. Tommy Andres, Raghu Madhavan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishad Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.